Good morning, everybody. Hasn't the band been great this morning? Hasn't they been a blessing to us? It's been really amazing. Let's give them a round of applause, shall we? Why not? It takes me back sitting and watching them this morning, and Sarah leading in particular. I think about 3 years ago when we joined the church, Sarah, I think, was just about getting into leading worship, and she used to sit there on a keyboard. And she'd make a mistake, and she'd kill herself laughing. She couldn't stop laughing. Do you remember that? But how she's come on, I think it's amazing to see God working on the lives of our musicians. It's really amazing. And I just really want to talk about this morning, the way that God works in our lives and helps us as we move along in this journey that we're on together. My Bible under there. I've got my sports bottle from the gym, which is quite irrelevant this morning, given the subject. Because, I don't know, how have you been getting on with Corinthians? Yeah? Bit heavy, isn't it? It's a bit brutal. I think Corinthians, Paul's quite brutal to the Corinthians, don't you think? Some of the themes he's picking up, and he's not mincing his words. It's all a bit heavy, and you could say severe. But the fact is, the church at Corinth was a seriously troubled church. They'd compromised their faith. They'd allowed the church to become infected with sexual immorality. The church was also suffering splits and factions. They'd become crippled by abuse of the spiritual gifts. Frankly, they needed radical spiritual surgery. That's why Paul adopts such a severe tone throughout the book. In effect, this was apostolic authority in action. And Paul was very much the apostle of that church, and he was writing to them at a time of crisis. So you can imagine my delight there when Kerry asked me to speak from 1 Corinthians chapter 5 to chapter 9, picking, well, what should I talk about? Should I talk about sexual immorality? Should I talk about division in the church? And God was leading me, probably because it's a slightly less complex subject, to the idea that we'll come to in a moment, because Paul brings chapter 9 to a conclusion with a description of the race. We'll come back to that in a moment. You know, the city of Corinth was an important city in ancient Greece. It was ideally placed as a hub for commerce between Italy and Asia. Along with the flow of merchandise, Corinth also received travelers from east and from west, and it created a really ethnic diversity amongst the city's inhabitants. The Romans controlled Corinth, which allowed them to dominate east-west trade, but also they hosted the Isthmian Games, surpassed only in importance by the Olympic Games at that time. And it's clear that Paul draws on this to illustrate his point in the passage I'd like us to look at this morning. This is from 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and it's verses 24 to 27, and this is from the New International Version. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. So running a race is a theme that's been used several times during the New Testament epistles, or letters as they were. This is Hebrews chapter 12, probably most likely written by Paul. And this passage here, Hebrews 12 verse 1 to 2 in the New King James Version, says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. In another passage, Paul, writing towards the end of his life, he's writing to Timothy and draws on that same image. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7, he says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who've loved his appearing. Paul's teaching the early church the importance of developing and maintaining spiritual stamina and the dangers of becoming flabby Christians. Now, to be honest, this strikes a chord with me. Right now, I'm just reaching, I think it's day 8 of Hiker's 9-day intensive diet program. Last Sunday was day 1, and it was not a good day. Last Monday was day 2, it was an even worse day. But actually, on day 8, I'm actually starting to feel pretty good. Tomorrow is day 9, and then I do the great weigh-in and the great measure-in, and then I'll set on. But, you know, it's important. It's a strict diet, but, you know, it's in the same way that carrying excess weight can affect our physical health. So I think spiritual flabbiness, if we're not careful, can affect our spiritual health. Physical health is all about getting the right quantity of the right food and avoiding unhealthy food. Same with physical activity. There are activities that promote health, whilst on the other hand, engaging in the wrong activity or being sedentary is likely to lead to health problems. And yet, sometimes we need to take a diet, and even, like me, a 9-day detox. Our spiritual fitness works on similar principles. That's why, as a church, we've embarked on our diet and fitness regime. The Revealing Jesus series, if you've not got it, take a copy. I think there's probably still some on the welcome desk by the door. It's simply that. It's a little bit like Hiker's 9-day program. And basically, talk to Hiker later on if you want to hear more. And she'd be happy to sell you one. But the Revealing Jesus booklet is, in effect, our fitness and health regime for the church. This, along with the exercise of prayer, are the core components of any spiritual fitness program. And as we follow it, I think we'll discover our spiritual stamina starts to increase. In fact, what I'm discovering more and more about diet is it's more productive, certainly in these last 8 days, it's more productive for me to focus on what I can eat and enjoy that than fret about what I need to avoid. And I think there's something there that says, look, there's so much wealth and quality that we can enjoy, and let's not fret about the things that, quite frankly, would do us no good. It's clear that reading through 1 Corinthians that the Corinthian church had too much of the wrong food and was suffering a deficit of activity that would promote spiritual health. Too much unhealthy activity. Today's passage appears right in the middle of Paul tackling issues such as division within the church, incest even within the church, legal disagreements within the church, sexual immorality. He addresses questions around marriage, around Christian liberty, around order in worship, around the proper use of spiritual gifts. He corrects teaching on resurrection. And Paul uses the picture of an endurance race to drive home the warning to the Corinthian church of the implications of the path they were on. Now, the Isthmian Games I've mentioned, Corinth was the home of the Isthmian Games. A very good reason why I think this picture would have struck a chord and resonated with the Corinthians. This event was held every 2 years, 10 miles outside the city of Corinth. The Games would have brought people together from every part of the Mediterranean to compete and to watch. It was the sporting event of the year, drawing the empire's best talent together. Athletes would compete in foot races, long jumping, discus throwing, wrestling, boxing, gymnastics, and equestrian events. The competition would be fierce. All contestants had to endure 10 months of intensive training. Anyone who failed to compete the training program was barred from competing. The highlight of the games was the great endurance race. A bit like the marathon, I guess, at the end of our Olympics now. It was surely this race that Paul brought to mind to illustrate the faithful Christian church. However, as Paul points out in verse 24 of our passage, all compete, but only one wins the prize. So I wonder, what was this prize? There's a short little bit of video, I think. I've had to delve back to 2,000-year-old video here now, courtesy of Horrible Histories.
Celery. The prize is celery.
Yes, didn't you know?
No. I thought it was salary. A yearly wage, cash, dosh, wonga. I'm in it for the money.
Ah, well, the bad news is your prize is in fact just a celery hat.
What's the good news?
The good news is I bought this delicious Greek dip. Mmm, now that is rich.
Thanks, Graham. Yes, it's true. If you look at history, it tells us that although the Romans later changed the prize to a wreath of laurel. That's right. Thank you. Actually, initially, the prize was a celery crown. So you worked for 10 months. You competed in the most horrendous race, endurance race, and at the end of it, you won a crown of celery. That's why Paul says they do it to get a crown that will not last. Some versions call it the perishable crown. And that's exactly what the perishable crown was. And of course, the crown we win, it says here, will be an imperishable crown, or a crown that will last forever. Paul also makes it clear that we can all win the crown. So more like the London Marathon, I guess. I know, Steve, I was asking before, you've done 3 London Marathons. 2 London, 1 Abingdon. I meant to ask Steve to bring us his medal because he got a medal at the end of that. And everybody who competes and finishes the London Marathon, of course, gets a medal for achieving that. And that's the same in effect of the race we're in. Let's be clear, though. We don't win the crown because we run. That's really important that we understand that. We're not winning the crown because we run. That would inject a level of uncertainty. We don't, as Paul say, run with uncertainty. All who finish the race win a crown. 2 Timothy chapter 4, 7 and 8, we looked at it a minute ago, says, I've fought the race, good fight, I've finished the race, I've kept the faith, finally laid for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day. Not only to me, but also to all who've loved his appearing. Or as the Passion Translation says, and this crown is not only waiting for me, but for all who love and long for his unveiling. In other words, all who keep their eyes fixed on the face of Jesus, put their faith in him and keep their eyes fixed on him. Of course, it's also worth bearing in mind, the longer we run, the nearer we get to him. However, in the context of what's gone before in 1 Corinthians, it's clear to me that Paul in this passage is sending out a stern warning to the Corinthians and underlining to them the importance of running the race to preserve the grace of God in our lives. This is a key theme that we've seen running through Romans, the grace of God. But Paul is now talking about preserving that grace in our lives. It's a difficult message, but if we look at 2 Timothy a little bit further on in this passage, Paul talks about he rests in the satisfaction that he's finished the race. But in writing to Timothy, he also mentions a person called Demas, who he says, Demas has forsaken me, having loved the present world and has departed for Thessalonica. Here's a person who was working alongside Paul, who for whatever reason found it more attractive to look at the things in the world, found it more attractive to take off and go to Thessalonica. Goodness knows what lay in Thessalonica for him. So Paul clearly lays out a warning there. And I don't believe that it's necessarily that we lose the grace of God. We can't do that. But I think we have to be cautious as Christians. We're making solid decisions about continuing in the race that we're running. I think Hebrews 12 actually makes it clear that the root cause here is what I call flabby Christianity. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run the race with endurance that's set before us. Or as the Message translation puts it, I like this version, strip down, start running and never quit. No extra spiritual fat, no parasitic sins. The danger of spiritual flabbiness, as I've said, is not that we'll lose the grace, but we've got to keep focused on Jesus and making sure that the decisions we're taking are focused on him and the race we're running. So, what then are the key things we need to consider to keep us running? What do we need to do? How do we keep this? I think what we need to develop as Christians is a champion mindset. We need to develop and think the way that champions think. What are the characteristics of a champion? Well, champions have a dedication to succeed, whatever the cost. You see somebody who has achieved remarkable things, be it in the Winter Olympics as we're watching right now, be it in the General Olympics, be it in football, whatever sport, they will have proven their dedication to succeed. They'll have a passion for the game, which goes beyond everything else. You could even call it an obsession for the game. They'll display a single-minded determination and focus on what they're doing. They'll show a willingness to train incessantly. One of my heroes was Eric Cantona. I'm a Manchester United supporter. So we do still bleat on about him. Those of you that know football know he left years ago. But I remember we went to Old Trafford one Sunday, took the kids. Outside, it was closed. There was nothing going on. We went to the big mega store, and I took my Christina and Michael with us. They were younger then. And a crowd started to gather, and all the players were coming out of the entrance, the players' entrance. And they'd all been training, so we waited and got their autographs as they all came out one by one. They were the glory days. And we waited, and there was one player who didn't come out, and that was Eric. Where's Eric? And Eric was a phenomenal player. A bit crazy, but a phenomenal player. Oh, Eric comes out after everybody else. He stays back and spends an extra half hour on his own just practicing more and more and more. That's the example of the true spirit of a champion. And all of this, of course, is driven by a burning desire to win the prize. That reflects the true spirit of a champion. And that, I suggest, is the kind of spirit we need to develop as Christians. Of course, in our spiritual race, we don't run it alone. We have Holy Spirit, or the Comforter, as he's referred to sustain us, to direct us, to support us. Let's face it, setbacks are inevitable. We will incur injury. Could be difficult circumstances. It could be illness. It could be financial difficulties. It could be losing our job. It could be losing friends. It could be an unkind word from a fellow Christian. Your Heavenly Father standing at the finishing line, waiting to say, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." If you've fallen, if you've stumbled, just reach out to him. But Mike, I hear you say, "I'm not an Olympic athlete." Then let me introduce you, just finally, to another person. This is Cliff Young. If you've heard of Cliff Young, in 1983, 150 world-class runners converged on Sydney for the world's longest and toughest ultramarathon. It was a grueling 543.7 mile endurance race from Sydney to Melbourne in Australia. And those of you that have been to Australia know that's a long way. On the day of the race, a toothless 61-year-old potato farmer and sheep herder named Cliff Young approached the registration table wearing overalls and overshoes on his work boots. At first, people thought he was there to watch the race. But to their surprise, Cliff Young declared his intention to run and requested a number. You see, Cliff had grown up on a large farm in Australia without the benefits of luxuries like horses and four-wheel drives. When the storms rolled in, Cliff headed out to round up his 2,000 sheep around his 2,000 acres. Sometimes he had to run for 2 or 3 days to complete his roundup. The astonished staff issued Cliff his race number. When the gun went off, the The bystanders sniggered at Cliff, left behind in his galoshes and overalls, as the other runners with their sculpted bodies ran. Sniggers gave way to laughter when they saw him run. Not like other runners, but he had a sort of weird, what can only be described as a shuffle. It later became known as the Cliff Shuffle. All of Australia was riveted to the live telecast as they watched the scene unfold, and Cliff fell further and further behind. Someone should stop that crazy old man before he kills himself, they said. 5 days, 15 hours, and 4 minutes later, Cliff Young came shuffling across the finish line in Melbourne. 9 hours, 56 minutes ahead of the nearest competitor. Cliff won the race. And if you don't believe me, look it up on the internet. Australia was stunned. This was remarkable, seemingly impossible. How on earth did it happen? Everyone knew that to run the ultramarathon, runners would run for 18 hours, then they'd stop and they'd sleep for 6 hours. This routine was separated, was repeated for 5 days. Everybody knew, except nobody had told Cliff. He just shuffled along day and night, night and day, without stopping to sleep. Cliff broke the previous race record by 9 hours and became an overnight a national hero. Victory in the Christian life comes through endurance. The Christian life isn't a 100-yard sprint. It's a marathon. In the short distance, speed's important. In the long distance, endurance is what leads to success. In the race of the Christian life, some things are standard for us as Christians. But for each one of us, you know, the encouragement I want to bring this morning is that we should each run our own race in our own way, with the gifts and talents that God has endowed upon us. Reading Cliff's story, for some reason I could just remember the verse in Isaiah. And I felt God saying, look, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it? I will make a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. I believe that God is telling us he wants to do a new thing with us. I believe he wants to take us as a church to places we've never been to before. I believe he wants to see rivers in the desert. Cliff Young wasn't constrained by how to run the ultramarathon. He wasn't restricted by watching how others had done it before him. Their traditions, their practices, their routines, their rituals. He simply ran his own race. Let's be brave enough to let God do a new thing in our lives and in our church. Let's have the courage to look beyond the perceived logic, to put aside the tried and tested formulae. Let's seek God for how he would have us to run. Cliff's strength was his ignorance. Ignorance of rules and what he ought to do. What he ought to wear. How he ought to run. I think sometimes we do become bogged down by what we've always done and what we ought to do. Cliff wasn't an elite athlete, but nonetheless, he had what it took to take on the best and win. I wonder, can we as a church take that on board and seek God for a new thing? I wonder, are you, as an individual, prepared to let God lead you to a new place in your spiritual life? If you look at the times throughout church history when God has moved in a special way, it's always been when men and women have broken with tradition, have stepped out from the routine, the ritual, the liturgy, and have done their own thing within the will of God. So this morning, I believe there are three specific areas into which we need to pray. Because God is prepared to come and meet you where you are this morning. I'm going to invite the band to return. They'll be leading us through worship. But before they do, I've got three questions. Yeah, please come up and start playing. First of all, my first challenge of three is, have you even started the race yet? When Jesus died on the cross, he did it so that you and I can qualify for this great race. I'm going to pray a short prayer in a moment, a prayer of commitment. And if you've never prayed that prayer before, I invite you this morning to pray that prayer. Perhaps you're struggling to keep up. Have you reached the point where, frankly, you're not sure you can keep on? Have you reached the point where you're not sure you can keep running? Have you stumbled and fallen just too many times? God is saying to you this morning, don't be discouraged. Don't give up. Just reach out to Him, and He's ready to pick you up this morning. Get you back on your feet. Get you running again and lean on Him. Or are you prepared to let God start a new thing this morning? A new thing in your life? Are we as a church prepared to let God take us to where we've never been before?